Our guest this morning is Dr. Aaron Beck. He's known as the founding father of cognitive therapy. He's the director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy in Philadelphia. He is also a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is the author or co-author of 5 books on anxiety, depression, and suicide, and is the author of the newly published book, Love is Never Enough. It's about how couples can overcome misunderstandings, resolve conflicts, and solve relationship problems through cognitive therapy. And it's just recently been published by Harper and Row. Again, as we talk with Dr. Beck, we invite you to participate in the show. If you have comments or questions, you share them with us just by calling, giving us a call. Dr. Beck, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Pretty good. I'm glad that you could be with us. Perhaps first, I tried, to, and I think perhaps it was before we got you on the line, to give a quick description of what cognitive therapy is all about. But I would like to start by having you do that, because I'm not quite sure that my explanation would be adequate, and I want to get on people to get it right from the source. What's the basic thinking that underlies cognitive therapy?
Well, just in a nutshell, cognitive therapy is actually a thinking therapy. It has to do with the way people think their way into problems through using poor logic, jumping to conclusions, and so on. And it helps people through getting them to think their way out of problems by testing the evidence, using more logical thinking, and being more empirical, experimental in jumping to conclusions. We discovered a long time ago that people who were depressed had a particular way of looking at the world as though everything was being seen through dark-colored glasses, and they tended to interpret everything negatively. And we found that much of the interpretations were based on faulty thinking. However, it turns out that people who are in marital problems also show the same type of faulty thinking that depressed people do, but in this case, the negative thinking is directed not against themselves, but against their mate. And so they tend to see themselves as the victim, and they tend to see the mate as the villain in every situation. And so when the mate acts in a neutral way, they might see that as bad. And if the mate acts in a somewhat mildly obnoxious way, they see this as terrible. And the most important thing is that they tend to screen out the good, positive, nice things that the mate does. They don't see it, they don't recall it, and they don't even know that it happens. Now, cognitive therapy teaches people how to perceive things more accurately, how to catch themselves when they jump to conclusions and correct their erroneous conclusions, and how to actually see their own mate more realistically so they can get a much more loving bond recreated between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. The title of your book suggests that, the title of the book, Love is Never Enough, suggests that you do have, and I know that you do have, a list, perhaps, of the other things that are necessary. So perhaps the question is, if love's not enough, then to maintain a loving relationship, what else do you need?
Yes. Well, you're right, David. Love can bring people together, but it can't really keep them together. In general, you have to have respect, sensitivity, and understanding if you're going to be successful with your mate. Now, these are qualities that can be acquired, and they don't necessarily follow from love. A psychiatrist, for example, can show these 3 qualities without at all being in love or even having affection for the patients. But most people get into a marriage situation without having any skills at all in close, intimate relationships. Usually their models are highly idealized, such as what they might get from the media, from movies and television, or their models may be their parents, who are often quite distressed or even disturbed themselves. And so the individuals getting into a marital situation or into a close, intimate relationship haven't really learned through either experience or observation how to form a good, durable, pleasing, happy relationship. And I have a series of questions that I ask people who come to me for counseling, and I could just run down some of these things. For example, what is important in a relationship is caring. You'd think this would go with love, but it doesn't come automatically. And you have to ask yourself, are you concerned about your partner's welfare? Do you share pleasure with your partner? Do you share your partner's pain? Another very, very important aspect of a close, intimate relationship is acceptance and tolerance. Can you accept differences of opinions and tastes and style? And do you accept your partner in totality, including the weak points, which we all have, as well as the strong points, or are you critical all the time of the weak points? Another category is something we call empathy. When your partner is feeling down, do you find you can share some of that feeling? People can fill out this checklist and see where they're falling down in terms of the intimate relationship, and it's possible by going down this list, which we provide in the book that you just mentioned, you can see where your own weaknesses are in terms of the intimate relationship, and it tells you just where you can start to get to work in improving, making your relationship a much happier one.
Mm-hmm. About half of the book is devoted to some of the common problems that you and others have encountered as you have counseled couples.
Yeah.
And I would like to talk about some of these things because I'm sure that once we talk a little bit about them, people listening will, as I said before, they'll see themselves. They'll say, yes, undoubtedly some of these things, they'll say, yes, I have done those things.
Sure.
And maybe then we could also talk about how to try and prevent yourself from doing some of these things, keep from doing that. The first one, and I know that this is something that I have done, it may be one of the most common sorts of things, has to do with negative thinking. And what it means is what I understand it to mean is that something happens. Perhaps your mate says something or doesn't say something or does something, and without really trying to find out what is actually going on, what the other person is really thinking, you substitute a thought. You invent something, and it tends to be negative.
That's exactly right. For instance, you're at home after a hard day at work, waiting for your wife, who's also working, and she's late. And thought goes through your mind very quickly, well, she really doesn't care about me. She's probably dawdling along the way. If she really cared, she would make sure that she'd be home on time. She's really rejecting me. She's not a good wife. She's not a good mother. And so you move from a specific jumping to conclusion to a very broad statement about your wife. Your wife comes home, and you're already stiff and got a drawn face, and she was expecting, let's say, somebody is going to give her a warm greeting. So she sees this kind of sullen look in your face, and so immediately she's disappointed, and she withdraws from you. And then you think, aha, you see, this proves I was right. She really wasn't anxious to come home. She really is rejecting me. She really doesn't care about me. And what cognitive therapy tries to do is to get you to catch these conclusions that you reach and look for other explanations. She might have been seeing a client late. She could get tied up in traffic. She might have gone out with some of her friends to just relax for a period of time before coming home. A whole host of other explanations would be available to you if you stop to think about them.
Hmm. Why is it that people seem to want to reach for the negative explanations first?
Well, in intimate relationships, the relationship is so important that any little negative aspect of the relationship might mean to you that it could snowball and mean the end of the relationship. And so while you go into a close relationship or marriage for security, safety, and helping relationships, you are highly sensitized to the loss of any of these qualities, and so you're going to be looking for any sign that there might be a rejection there, and you're going to be personalizing, so anything that happens between the two of you, you're so prone to think that this is because of my mate's attitude towards me, and the reason you're looking that way is because the relationship is so important to you. And important relationships do tend to bring out this type of thinking.
Hmm. That's interesting, because some people might suggest that the difficulty nowadays with relationships is that people don't care about them enough. And what this would suggest would be that people obviously are caring about them very deeply, so deeply that they're terribly afraid that the slightest thing can upset the apple cart.
Right, and it's not quite as contradictory as it might seem, because in the current day situation, we do go into relationships with our nerves exposed, and we do feel very vulnerable. But we don't have the same degree of commitment that perhaps people in the past have had. And so as soon as our nerve endings jangle a little bit, we tend to pull back. And we pull back, it is possibly true, we won't get hurt as easily, but the relationship then becomes less meaningful to us.
Mm-hmm. You also talk in a section about a section that you have, a chapter that you have titled The Light and the Darkness, about the fact that relationships can, the tone of relationships can shift, and it is common for a couple, as particularly in their courtship phase, to perhaps have unrealistic expectations or images of the other. That is, the tendency is for everything to be wonderful, for the other person to be perfect. And after some period of time, some of these couples can go from everything wonderful, the other person perfect, to everything horrible, the other person a louse. And I wonder if that means that at the outset people were not seeing each other correctly, or is the distortion coming later?
There's a couple of things, David. As part of the infatuation process, research has shown that people really do exaggerate the positive. It's as though nature is forcing an exaggerated positive image onto us to make sure that we do mate or couple. And so we tend to idealize the mate and see the mate on a pedestal, on as a Prince Charming or Cinderella or whatever. And the exaggerated expectations then are bound to be thwarted because nobody can live up to this image. We then do a flip-flop and then go to the other extreme. So if our mate is not totally responsible, we then go over and see the mate as irresponsible. If the mate is not totally loving all the time, then we see the mate as rejecting. If the mate is not sensitive to our needs at a particular time, then we flip to the insensitive. And the flip-flop is partly generated by the fact that these relationships are really so important to us. Getting into a permanent relationship to many people does represent life or death, or certainly happiness or unhappiness. And, of course, that's why they like to leave the door open for an exit, so that once a person starts to feel unhappy after the stage of disillusionment, instead of trying to work it through and get to a more realistic image of the mate, which is somewhere between the light and the darkness, they react to that hurt by either feeling extremely angry or disappointed and wanting to exit.
You also talk about the fact that, and it's a natural enough thing, that different people, the different members of the couple, look at the world in very different ways, and that's as it should be, and perhaps, you know, that's a good thing, because if we all really viewed the world in the same way, it wouldn't be a very interesting world. But that can also lead to conflict as well. And it seems that this and the business of the light and the darkness, the central idea is that for a relationship to really be successful over the long term, you have to be able to see the other partner, see your partner for what he or she really is, to have a realistic reading of that person, and further, to be able to, in some way, see the world as they see it and acknowledge that that's a legitimate way of looking at things and that your way is not the only way. But that's very difficult.
That is difficult, but it's important to know that such a situation does exist. Now, as you mentioned, no couple are clones of each other, so you do get these differences not only in taste and opinion and mannerisms and so on, but you do get a different perception of the same situation. And if your mate perceives your behavior as threatening when it isn't meant to be threatening, and you see her behavior or his behavior as threatening when it isn't intended to be threatening, you're going to get a clash of perspectives. For instance, a wife is busy putting a picture on the wall, and she's having a little bit of trouble, but she thinks, I want to do it my way, and this is fine. Then her husband comes over and thinks, oh, she's in trouble, I'm going to help her. The wife then bristles and says, leave me alone, I can do it myself. He then feels rejected because he's trying to help her and she's not being reasonable. Now, from her perspective, it's very important that she demonstrate to herself that she can be relatively independent and can do things herself and has some manual ability. From his perspective, his wife is a dependent person who needs help. Now, they both may be correct in a way, that she could use help, but they're both wrong in a way in that they interpret the other's behavior as obnoxious. Now, if they know that there's a little bit of a conflict, they could just ask each other, well, what is it that's behind this? Instead of the wife snarling at him at the very beginning, she could ask him, well, why is it that you feel you need to help me? She could just ask a question, and then he could answer it, and then she'd say, well, that's okay, but I'd like to do it myself. But not realizing that they have different perspectives, each one is likely to see the other person as ungrateful or intrusive or some such, which is totally incorrect.
We're talking this morning on Focus 580 with Dr. Aaron Beck. He is director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is the author of a number of books, including a most recently published Love is Never Enough. We're talking about some of the difficulties that couples can have, the kinds of misunderstandings and problems in communication that they can have, and then perhaps how, through using some of the principles of cognitive therapy, those things can be dealt with. If you have questions for us, maybe you'd like to call in, you have some experience of your own to offer, or questions about your own relationship, you can talk with our guest, Dr. Beck, and our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. The toll-free line is good anywhere in the state. That's 800-222-9455. What, in some way to your book, my reaction and perhaps the reaction of others would be that it makes a great deal of sense, and that in a sense that's a problem, because what you're asking people to do is be rational, but people are not always very rational beings, especially if they're in a situation that is very emotionally charged. It's difficult when you're in a situation like that to, in a sense, what you have to do is stop yourself. If your emotions are starting to surge, you actually have to say, wait a minute, and stop things completely and take a step back and look at what's going on, how you're reacting to the situation, what your underlying thoughts are. And it seems that may be a very difficult thing to ask people to be able to do in situations that are very tense or intense.
Well, David, you're absolutely right, and the prescription you propose is also quite correct. Once you start to feel some irritation or anger come up, you do have to do a freeze frame, as it were. Stop right there, withdraw from the situation, and then ask yourself, what am I thinking right now? And then try to see whether the thinking is wrong. Now, at the beginning, of course, it takes practice. But in our other human relations, we can do that. We can do it in work situations. We can do it in situations with strangers where we might be irritated, but we don't express the irritation, and we can give ourselves other explanations because it's not such a vital part of our life. In the case of couples therapy, the people can apply these rational methods at first through a certain degree of voluntary effort. But after a while, it becomes automatic, David. It's similar to when I was in England a couple of years ago, and I had to learn how to drive all over again, as it were, because I had to drive on the other side of the road. The steering wheel was on the other side. It made my turns quite differently and so on. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of thought and effort for 2 days. And then after a while, the new pattern of driving became so automatic with me that it just happened without any effort at all. And this is what we found with people who are in distressed relationships, that they can pull back, and after a while it becomes a habit, and they don't have to work at it anymore.
Yeah. What much of what you talk about is communication, how communication can sometimes go wrong, and how you can work to try to have effective communication. And certainly if there is one thing that I have learned being in broadcasting is that often people do not hear what you say, and sometimes they hear things that you did not say. And that happens also in daily communication between people. What would be some of the most basic things that people can think about or try to do to improve their communications, to not only to be clear when they are trying to give an important message to someone else, but also to make certain that they are really hearing what another person, their spouse in particular, is saying?
Well, David, of course you touch on a very important point, and what you really need to do first is diagnose just what's wrong in communication. And there are no two couples that have the same communication problems. So I provide a checklist which will tell you examples of what could be wrong in the way you communicate and the way your partner communicates to you. And if you fill out the checklist and have your partner fill out the checklist, you can see where the static gets into the communications. So you first have to diagnose the problem and see whether it's that your partner talks too much, your partner doesn't listen, your partner interrupts, and so on. But that really isn't enough. There are certain rules, guidelines for improving communication, and you have one set of guidelines for the speaker and the other set of guidelines for the listener. These guidelines are very important when you're talking about an emotionally charged subject where you're likely to go off on a tangent or you're likely to start alienating one another. And so the rules would be something like this. For the speaker, you have to try to be clear and concise and stick to the point. Don't make any dirty digs. Try not to be short-winded. Try to look for signs that your partner is understanding you or not understanding you, and so on. Then there are rules for the listener. The listener has to pay attention, be attentive, has to not interrupt for at least a sufficient period of time, has to give feedback at times to make sure that he or she has really gotten the sense of it. So I might say to my mate, what you're trying to tell me is that if I would just spend a half hour every night, say playing cards with you or taking the children out, that this would be a big load off your shoulders. Is that what you're trying to say? And then my mate would say, well, no, it's not that at all. It's just that I would like you to be available when I need you. And so then you can get the communication going, and problems that may have troubled a relationship for years or even decades can get worked out sometimes in just a few minutes if people will just observe the few basic rules of proper communication.
We are at about midpoint here in our conversation. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Beck about some of the ideas in his book, Love is Never Enough. He is the director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy at University of Pennsylvania. This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and this morning we're talking about building strong relationships, and we have as our guest Dr. Aaron Beck. He is the founder of Cognitive Therapy. He's the director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy in Philadelphia, and he is also a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He is the author of the recently published book, Love is Never Enough. It's published by Harper and Row, and we've been talking about some of the things in the book this morning. If you have some questions for us, you're welcome to call in and talk with our guest. All you need to do is pick up the telephone. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois, use our toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Well, let's take our first caller here, someone on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, howdy there.
Yes.
I just have a small statement to make. Don't you agree that maturity and age has a lot to do with the jealousy type things? Because I can remember, oh, I'd say 10 years ago, you know, I'd get very upset and, you know, worried and everything about, you know, going out with a girl or something like that. And as I got older and matured, it seemed like, you know, things like that weren't that important. I was more sure of myself. So don't you, you know, just age and maturity finally calms those feelings down, or do people, some people keep those feelings forever?
Yes. Well, that's a very good question, a very good statement. Usually in the early days or years of a relationship, each partner may feel very vulnerable and insecure. With the passage of time, when people become more sure of themselves, more self-confident, and more sure of the mate, then the sense of insecurity goes away. And when the insecurity goes away, then the jealousy does. But as you indicated, some people may keep the jealousy right through the entire relationship. And then the basic cause is usually this insecurity, the sense of vulnerability, the fear that the mate may lose them. And so when your mate or partner starts to show any type of interest, which can be completely platonic, in another person, your thought is, I may lose her, this is terrible, I must do something to get my clutches into her so that she won't stray. And basically that is what occurs in a jealous-type reaction.
Yes, I know a young couple now, and they even get jealous over, like, movie stars or something. If one of them says, oh, I think he's really cute or something, you know, the other one, it really bothers them, and I just find this really amazing. I mean,
yeah, you know what goes through their mind is, how can, he really can't love me if he thinks that so-and-so is such a beautiful gal, or if he's attracted to this beautiful woman in the screen, he's going to be attracted perhaps to some other beautiful woman who is much more accessible. And so this represents a threat, and you can get at the threat actually by asking people what is going through your mind. It's usually something really quite ridiculous, such as, he can't really love me if he's showing an interest in this person on the
side. But most people grow out of this type of jealousy, don't you think?
I would say perhaps about 80% of the people do, and the other 20% are the ones who really need help with it. And oftentimes, just by understanding it, you can educate yourself and understand it and get over it that way. But if it stays on, then just understanding it through reading won't be sufficient, and one does have to get counseling. And we do see some people who have what we call pathological jealousy, where none of the education itself is able to reverse the process, and then they have to get into treatment and get to the roots of the insecurity.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, and we'd appreciate other folks if you have questions or comments here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I'm glad that the caller raised that issue, because it's something that I had been thinking about myself, and at least thinking about my own experience, and thinking that that I would hope that I would be better able to do some of the kinds of things you talk about now than I would have when I was much younger, and thinking that perhaps one of those things that has to happen to a person is the kind of seasoning that comes with age, and maybe maturity is one way to talk about it, that somehow maybe, and it maybe it's not true for everyone, that it does get a little easier as you get a little older.
Oh, I'm sure it does. When we're young, we're so fragile and vulnerable that almost anything can make us fear that we're going to lose something that we need very much. But with maturity, you get a much more balanced view of life and of other people, and you get a much greater perspective than you have when you're young.
Well, I have another call. Let's talk with someone here on line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your guest could comment on outside sources, you know, making judgments or something on a relationship, and you know, like if you have a volatile situation in the first place and then outside friends or whatever just add to it, how would you handle something like that?
So what you're saying, people are already in a relationship, and it's a committed relationship, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just testing the waters with a new relationship, is that correct?
Correct.
And people add fuel to the fire by making uncomplimentary or
right.
problematic statements about your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, how can you kind of shut out what they're saying, which may be a reflection of their own emotions, and try to work out your own specific problems? Is that more or less what the question is?
Well, yeah, I guess I was thinking, do you need to just tell these friends something, or, you know, do you touch on this in your book, or, you know, what would...
Yeah, well, I think when you're trying to work out a relationship yourself and you're going about it in an educated way, outside people can really upset the apple cart. And I think what you need to do is to say something along these lines is, look, I'm trying to work out this relationship, and for the time being, let me just work it out my own way.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do want some help later on, could I call on you then and ask for your opinion? So we want to leave the door open and want to, of course, maintain our outside friendship. And so we want to end on sort of an upbeat note that I think I can do it myself, but I'd like to be able to call on you and get your advice if I can.
That sounds real positive. Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right,
okay,
thank you.
Bye.
I think we're getting somebody else. No? Oh, okay. I'll just give the telephone number again. I thought we were getting another caller there. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I think in any relationship, there's going to be some kind of conflict. People will feel their expectations will, in some cases, not be met. They will feel frustration. They will feel disappointment. They will feel hurt. And all of those things can lead to anger. And, of course, anger can very quickly escalate and get out of control. How do you deal with these first, with the perhaps the first steps, the things that can lead to anger before they get there and it does get out of hand?
Well, the first thing you have to do, David, is recognize when you're getting the early signs of anger. Some people may feel a flutter in their heart, others a wrenching of the stomach. One person said he could feel something like a slap in the face. Other people may notice that their fists are clenched, starting to dig into their hands. And if they're not aware of the early signs and there's something they want to discuss with the mate, what they want to discuss in, say, a reasonable way may come out as an attack on the mate. And so the problem isn't presented in a solvable way, but it's presented as a first shot in upcoming warfare. And so first you need to recognize that the anger is there and try to relax and be really careful the way you phrase the question. If, for example, you're upset about the division of chores, instead of saying the kitchen's a pigsty, try to translate that into a specific request, starting with the word I, like such as, I would really appreciate it if you could get the dishes washed before I come home from work or before we go to the office together or some such. Or instead of saying, I hate when you, instead of saying, you are repulsive when you come to bed with brushing your teeth and there's alcohol in your breath, you could say, I'd like to make love with you, but it would be so much nicer if you brushed your teeth and you didn't have six or eight beers before you came to bed. So you want to put things in a somewhat upbeat way, but be very specific about the request itself. If you put the request in an attacking or reproachful way, the other person's going to react not to the request, but to the reproach. And then, obviously, will feel hurt and angry, and will then not respond to what may be a very, very reasonable request.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think you have a section where you list a lot of the sort of twists in thinking that can make things worse, and you just made me think about something that I'm sure, again, is a common sort of thing, which is overgeneralization, and that the easiest way to describe it to people is to say, watch out for statements that you make that include one of two words, always or never.
Yes.
And somehow that really came home to me, that there's the tendency to say to the other, you always do such and such, or you never do such and such. And,
yes,
of course, there are very few alwayses or nevers in life, but it's so easy to blow things out of proportion.
It's easy to blow it out of proportion, and of course you then are going to react to the always never statement by feeling very angry or very hurt. And what you want to do is to try to translate this into a very specific type of statement, so that instead of saying, you always criticize my family, you could say, you know, it really hurt me the other day when you told people that my brother was a drunkard. Make it very specific, and then let your mate do the generalizing. And your mate may then catch on without having to spell it out ever again that you would prefer that he or she not talk about your brother, and may even then generalize it to the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some other callers here. Let's talk with them to someone on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Very interesting program. I'd like to ask Dr. Beck about how one would apply the techniques to adult children, sons and daughters, and also what is a good way to explain to people that you'd rather they not tell you how you feel. If somebody says to me, oh, you're angry or you're upset, it really annoys me. What's a good way to explain that you'd rather not have someone else tell you how you feel?
Yes. Well, the second part, then we'll get to the first part, is a matter of being able to say things in a diplomatic way. And that will vary from one person to another. Some relationships can be so frank and open that you could easily say without the other person being hurt, I would just as soon you didn't, or I prefer that you not tell me about my feelings because I'm close enough access to my feelings. On the other hand, other people might be hurt by such a statement because they may think that they're trying to help you. And so in a case like that, say, well, you may be right that I'm angry, but I really don't think so, but I'll think about it.
Mm.
And then if they do it again, say, well, I'm still thinking about the last time you told me. If they do it a third time, say, I still haven't made up my mind about what I feel, but I'll be sure and tell you as soon as I know.
Okay.
By then, that may turn them off. Now, on the adult children, that's a tricky area, very tricky area. Now, how old are the adult children?
In their 30s.
Yes. Even in their 30s, although children are supposed to be mature in relationship to their parents, they are often just as immature as when they were 10 or 12 or 14 or 16 or 18. And you do have to use a lot of diplomacy in the way you talk and realize that they are still very much threatened by you, and don't react strongly to what they may say. For example, you might see that adult daughter really isn't doing what you know from experience, what is really best for her own children. Now, if you come in and say, I think you should be more strict with the children, I think you're disciplining them too much, she's going to take that as a put-down. And so you have to say it in a somewhat different way. And oftentimes it's best probably not to say anything. But if it's really crucial, you could say something like, you know, I was reading the other day that many parents really do not structure their children's lives enough, and that they really should try to organize the kids a little bit better, be stricter about bedtime and so on. Say, what do you think about that? Do you think there's any credence in that sort of thing? So try to sometimes put things in a third person or an anecdotal way so that they won't be overly sensitive about it.
Does any of this appear in your book?
The principles of talking to adult children aren't listed as such, but
you can find them.
But the same guidelines can be used as in, say, the parent-to-parent relationship as can be used with the adult children. Mm-hmm. And the same guidelines in talking. Don't say too much. Try to be concrete. Stick to the point. Don't make any digs. Don't reproach, and so on. And try to just be informative. I think that is the key thing, is just try to pass on information. And if the other person doesn't take it, remember that it may take time to register. And while they may not show any response right now, it may be a month or a year later, sometimes even longer, you'll find that they're doing exactly what you had proposed a long time ago.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you for the call. We'll be here for about another 10 minutes. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Beck. He's director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the newly published book, Love is Never Enough. It's about how couples can overcome misunderstandings, resolve conflicts, and solve relationship problems through cognitive therapy. We have another caller here on our toll-free line, and we have time for some others if you'd like to call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We have another person here on our toll-free line. That's where we will go next. Hello.
Good morning, David. Good
yes.
morning, Dr. Beck. I'd like you to discuss what influence TV has on expectations in marriage, such as soap operas and primetime families. You know, they look wonderful on TV, but we can't script our lives to meet that type of situation. I was wondering if you could discuss that, and I'll hang up the list.
Well, okay. Many of the TV programs, and as well as the movies, give an unrealistic view of what marriage is all about. And when we expect our marriage to work out that way, with song and laughing and standing around the piano having great times together and never having any quarrels, if we use that as the standard method, we're going to get really disappointed and hurt when our own partners don't live up to those particular expectations. Now, there are some TV programs that do communicate the real type of conflicts that people have and sometimes even show how they solve them. Something like 30-something does show typical young couples in their 30s and the type of problems that they have and how they do tend to overgeneralize and show the selective abstraction and so on. Since it's a TV production, though, and not a therapy production, it doesn't really show how people can solve the problems. But at least it does give a realistic picture as to the types of problems that people do have.
Okay, I hope that gets at the question of the caller, and perhaps if she'd like to follow up, she can certainly call back. Something that I have been thinking about, Dr. Beck, is, again, it still seems to boil down to communication. I mean, one of the most important things, one of the most fundamental things, I think, that comes through in your book and in the way you think about relationships, it all revolves around communication. But what I wonder is that why it is that it seems so difficult for one person to ask another what's going on, why it seems to be, instead of assuming that the other person is angry, why does it seem so difficult for one to say to the other, are you angry with me, are you upset, or to talk about expectations before they get shattered? You know, you talk in the book about the fact that people have in their head certain expectations of what the other person is going to do, and that may be expectations that are never communicated to the other.
Yes.
And yet, when the person doesn't meet them, then when the other person in the couple doesn't meet them, then you end up feeling like, well, this person is no good. They don't really love you because they didn't meet these expectations that you never shared with them in the first place.
Yes. Well, first of all, I think it's natural, when your partner is angry at you, to want not to ask, because you never know what your partner is going to come up with, and you might get a real big denunciation.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes that isn't the case. For instance, you may have been, say, having a picnic with your partner. This is actually something that did come out of 30-something. And everything has gone very, very well. And then at the end, you find that your partner seems to be quite distressed and irritated at you, and you have no idea. So you ask her, what's bothering you? You seem to be
be angry about something. And she says, well, when I asked you to get the hot dogs and put them in the pot, you didn't do it. And you say, oh, is that what it was? Well, I actually didn't hear you. I guess I was engaged in a conversation, and I didn't hear you. And it turns out that something that is made into a monstrous crime is just a very simple act of omission. And then you can somehow reassure your mate, and the mate will be less angry, but also it may sensitize you to the future that when you're doing something together, that you be more aware of your mate's needs and maybe periodically check in and see if there is something that you want. So it can be a very important learning experience, but it's very important for both of you to be very concrete, very specific, and instead of blaming your mate, just try to say what it was that troubles you that your mate did, and leave the door open for your mate to make some type of adjustment or correction in his or her behavior.
Hmm. Okay. We have another caller here on our line number one. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Beck.
Yes, good morning.
I was kind of interested in your conversation and everything on anger that I've listened to. And I had another fellow from the state of Pennsylvania give me some good advice in that one time.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of interesting. It was a Dr. Laskonski.
Yeah.
And he was talking, he says, you know what anger is? He says, it's a God, he says, it is you having a God-given emotion saying, how dare you do the things that you want to do the way you want to do them as opposed to the way that I want you to do them.
Well, that's a very good definition.
And every time I look at that and I begin to get angry at something, then I look at that and I kind of smile at myself.
Yeah, well, I think that's terrific. I hope the rest of the audience will pick that up. That's a nice formula.
But he is in some of the fields of work, like, say, you know, he has devoted most of it to the beauty industry in the last few years.
Yes.
And he has given a great deal of training to a lot of different hairstylists throughout the country on this, on stress and emotion and so forth. But it's interesting that... it's just kind of a...
It's great, you know, what you're bringing out is part of a broader thing, too, which is the ability to laugh at yourself. We take ourselves so seriously all the time, and we think it's such a tragedy if we don't get what we want, and that the other person is such a villain if he or she doesn't come through. You have to look at it objectively and see, now, isn't this silly or isn't this humorous, that just because we don't get a little request or expectation met, that we're all ready to get our stomachs churning and ready to... ream out the partner when it really doesn't affect the life of the world or our own lives, really.
We're at the point where we're going to have to stop as we've used up our time. There is one just final thing I'd like to ask. You make the point very early in the book that you're assuming that only one member of the couple will read it or perhaps is reading it. So the question is, if you are concerned about the quality of your relationship and you want to talk about that with the other member of your spouse, your partner, how do you do that? How do you even start that conversation?
Well, first of all, I would hope that both partners would read it, and we do have checklists for each partner to make out. But it's just on past experience, oftentimes it's just the one spouse that will really read the book, and then he or she could say to the other spouse, look, here's a section I'd like you to read, and maybe we could then discuss it. If that doesn't work, you could say, now, in this book that I just read, the doctor says that it's much better to put complaints in the form of requests, and instead of saying, you always let me down, say, I would appreciate it if we could do things better together. Then ask your spouse how he or she feels about that. So you can take over the role of the educator. You can be the doctor or the counselor and so on. But you have to put it in a tactful way. And you can't do it all at once. I think sometimes just 1 or 2 minutes a day of getting across a point may really be sufficient in the long run to turn around an entire marriage relationship.
Okay. Well, we have just hinted at what is in the book. There is much, much more, and I would suggest people take a look at it. The title of the book is Love is Never Enough. It's published by Harper and Row by Aaron Beck. Dr. Beck, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, David, it's been a real pleasure being on the program, and perhaps I can do it again sometime.
We will keep that in mind. Thank you.
Fine. Thanks.